This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Hugo Chavez really angers and annoys a lot of people. The Venezuelan president's style is confrontational, and he often attacks the United States in general and President Bush in particular. At the United Nations a year and a half ago, he denounced President Bush as the devil. President Chavez supports Marxist rebels in the neighboring country of Colombia, a group that described as terrorists by the United States and the UN. He's still popular in his own country, mostly among the poor, but he's often criticized as a bully and a dictator. But just who is Hugo Chavez? What does he stand for? What does he want? Later on the opinion page, an argument to reinstate holidays on George Washington and Abraham Lincoln's birthdays and delete President's Day. But first, if you want to know more about the life, the popularity, and the politics of Hugo Chavez, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Bart Jones, who interviewed Hugo Chavez for a biography called Hugo. He joins us from member station WRHU in Hempstead, New York. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you, Neil.
And is there any easy way to summarize the politics of Hugo Chavez?
Well, you know, I think essentially Chavez is the poor people's president in Venezuela. I think one thing we need to keep in mind is that there's really been a kind of hysteria taking over the debate on Hugo Chavez. There's been this international image of him created of some kind of an evil monster, you know, massacring people down there or lining opponents up against the walls, against firing squads. And that's just not the reality. So I think we're hearing quite a bit of one side of the story about Hugo Chavez in the U.S. media, but not quite hearing that other side. And in the book I've written on Chavez, I've tried to present both sides in a fair way.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about his origins. Where did he grow up and where was he educated?
Well, Chavez was literally born in a mud hut. He was born in the living room of his grandmother's mud hut in the Great Plains of Venezuela. And he grew up in this mud hut, raised largely by his grandmother. As a boy, he dreamed of becoming a Major League Baseball player, and he was actually pretty good. So he came up with a plan to get into the West Point of Venezuela, which was the only way he could make it to the capital city and be discovered by Major League Baseball scouts. He does get into the West Point of Venezuela. However, once he gets there, he falls in love with the life of a soldier, and his dreams of becoming a Major League Baseball player begin to fade. He graduates from the West Point of Venezuela, and several years after that, he begins a decade-long secret conspiracy in the military. And this clandestine cell involves hundreds of other soldiers and cadets, leftist university intellectuals, and former guerrillas. And this clandestine cell is really quite remarkable. It goes on for a decade, and it's aimed ultimately at overthrowing the government of Venezuela. Chavez and his cohorts were outraged by the social inequality in Venezuela. It's an oil-rich country, and yet most of that wealth was controlled by a very small elite ruling class. At the same time, you had millions of poor people living in shacks and barely making enough to eat. So Chavez and his cohorts in 1992 launch a coup against the president at the time, Carlos Andrés Pérez. The coup fails militarily, but it succeeds politically. Chavez, who was unknown up until that time, becomes a hero to all of these poor people in the slums, who are happy that someone has risen up against this, what they view as a corrupt government. 3 years prior to that, there was a huge massacre in Venezuela in which the government literally mowed down hundreds, if not several thousand people in the streets after food riots broke out following the implementation of an IMF economic shock program. So Chavez had widespread support for this 1992 coup. He goes to jail for 2 years, gets out, spends several years crisscrossing the country trying to kind of figure out what to do next, and by 1998 runs for president. He runs against a 6'1" blonde, former Miss Universe, and this campaign was known as the Beauty and the Beast, and obviously Chavez was the Beast. The former Miss Universe was actually a very popular politician in Venezuela at that time. Venezuela is the beauty queen capital of the world, and people take it very seriously down there. And she was actually doing a pretty good job of running a district of Caracas at that time. So Chavez wins the election, obviously, in 1998 and goes on to become president. So that's really his life just up until the time he becomes president. All this kind of life and death action, which even if you really despise Hugo Chavez, I don't think you can deny that his life has been really quite fascinating.
Well, I was just going to ask, some people draw a parallel between him and another former pretty decent ball player named Fidel Castro.
Well, that's exactly right. Many people do. And however, I think it's fair to point out that there are some clear differences between Chavez and Castro. In Venezuela, thousands of people take to the streets to protest against Chavez. That doesn't happen in Cuba. People go on television and call Chavez a dictator. Again, this is not something that goes on in Cuba. He has been conducting free and fair elections in Venezuela and actually lost last December in a national referendum and accepted the results. So that's really not quite the type of thing that a dictator normally does.
Though the election, the basic question of the election was, can I be president for life?
That's right. That was one of the central questions. And Chavez clearly does not dislike power. I mean, he likes being there. But the people said no. And Chavez, up until now at least, is abiding by their vote. So there are some differences with Castro. There are obviously some similarities, too. They both say and claim that they are fighting for social justice in their countries and trying to empower these masses of poor people, which have been left out of Venezuela's oil wealth for decades.
In public, he sometimes comes across as flamboyant, sometimes as bombastic. You've had the opportunity to meet with him privately, to interview him. What's he like in person?
Well, he's not quite as flamboyant in person. You know, he really does kind of change when he gets up in front of 50,000 people and the rhetoric is quite fiery. In person, Chavez is really much more reflective and soft-spoken. I was able to interview him twice over a two-day period last year in the presidential plane, in the presidential palace. And he's a much more kind of thoughtful guy than he might appear to be sometimes in public with some of this very incendiary rhetoric.
And again, while we focus a lot on his confrontations with the United States and particularly with President Bush, he's had a lot of confrontations with his neighboring country, Colombia.
Well, that's right. Chavez ran into some conflict with Colombia over the negotiations of hostages being held there by the leftist guerrillas, the FARC. Just when it seemed that Chavez was on the verge of winning the release of three of these hostages, President Uribe in Colombia kind of pulled the plug on it due to some conflicts they were having. So, you know, the things have really heated up with Colombia. And again, though, I think we might want to mention here, you know, Chavez is always kind of seen as the bad guy. And, you know, he certainly has some flaws. That's quite apparent. And yet, you know, you never really hear about President Uribe and his government's apparent ties with paramilitary death squads. You know, there's no evidence at all that Chavez is involved in anything like that. And yet he seems to be the guy with this international image of this evil monster who's destroying democracy in Venezuela.
Well, is that an accurate representation? Is there democracy in Venezuela? Well, you mentioned the election last year, but other people have called him a bully.
Well, I think if we look at some of the basic definitions of democracy, there is a functioning democracy in Venezuela. And even some top U.S. officials have recognized that. The elections are free and fair. I mean, I don't think we can deny that at this point. Chavez lost last December and accepted the results, so that would indicate that these elections are fair. As I mentioned, you know, people go on television and call him a dictator, and nothing really happens. So there is certainly generally a free press in Venezuela, free elections. There's no doubt that Chavez is a strong president, however, let's not fool ourselves, and he does have a large amount of power in Venezuela. But I think to call him a dictator really doesn't fit the reality or the definition of a dictatorship.
And let me ask about his economic policies. He has nationalized some of the holdings there. And this is the basis, I guess, of the dispute with ExxonMobil is the way he treats the oil industry. Also has the benefits of, well, oil's been at record high prices for the last couple of years. Have those benefits actually flowed to the poor? Is their lot improved?
Well, right. I mean, on the first question, again, there was a lot of hysteria when Chavez made these moves against the oil companies last year. However, Venezuela's had nationalized oil since 1976, so he wasn't really taking over the oil industry. What he was doing was saying that in these joint projects we have with some international companies, we want to be the majority owner in these projects. So he was not throwing them out of the country. He was saying that we want to take majority control and we will compensate you for any losses that may take place as part of that process. So again, a little bit different than him simply seizing and expropriating without any compensation. Your other question on whether the benefits of these record high oil prices have flowed to the poor people, I think they certainly have to a degree. Chavez is really pumping and redirecting Venezuela's oil wealth to the majority poor in Venezuela, perhaps for the first time in the country's history. They have launched education programs in the poor barrios and slums, where they have taught 1.5 million people to read and write. And they have also stationed Cuban doctors in these poor neighborhoods where they live and provide preventative medical care 24 hours a day. So these are really clear signs of Chavez doing something concrete with the oil money, which is benefiting the poor majority. Are these programs perfect? Of course not. There's plenty of inefficiency. There's still corruption. There's still high crime rates in Venezuela. He's got a lot of issues that he needs to address, without doubt. But to say that it's been a complete disaster, I don't really think is a very fair assessment.
And some people argue, though, that if oil prices should come down, and someday they may, he will find himself in a lot of trouble.
He may well. However, they have also banked some of this oil money, for a rainy day. And does anybody really expect oil prices to, plummet back down to $20 a barrel? Unfortunately for U.S. consumers, probably not. But it is fair to say that the country remains overly dependent on oil, and Chavez does need to diversify the economy, and that's one of the challenges he faces in the coming year.
Stay with us, if you will, and when we come back, we'll take more calls, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We're talking, of course, about Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, the provocative and outspoken president of Venezuela. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's President's Day. A little later, we'll be talking about U.S. presidents. But this hour, we're also looking at the controversial president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. His larger-than-life persona has caused friction between him and the presidents of Colombia and the president of the United States. He's found allies with Iran, Syria, and Cuba. We're talking with Bart Jones. He's the author of Hugo, a biography of Hugo Chavez. But we want to know what you think. Is Chavez more diplomat or demagogue? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Joining us now is Fernando Coronil. He's the presidential professor of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. He's the author of The Magical State, a book about the democratic history of Venezuela. He's with us from our bureau in New York. And Fernando Coronil, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And is Venezuelan democracy safe in the hands of Hugo Chavez?
Well, I guess it's a difficult question. I think he has a different conception of democracy than many people have a view of democracy. And I think so far he has respected basic rules of democracy. So I think in general, I would say that it is safe.
How did he come to be elected president, do you think?
I think Bart Jones gave you, a pretty, very comprehensive account of his evolution. And I think one thing that I would add is to try to place Chavez in the larger context of Venezuelan history. And I think it's important for listeners to realize that Venezuela, in the context of Latin America, has a very special relationship to democracy in that, let's say, has one of the longest and most stable democracies in Latin America. And that's to a large extent because Venezuela, like other countries, has had a more stable economy, in part an economy sustained by petroleum. And petroleum was, Venezuela is also one of the earliest oil producers in the world. It was the major exporter by 1928. And the very conception of democracy in Venezuela was very much related. The way that Venezuelans began to understand what democracy was by thinking about Venezuela as a petroleum nation. Venezuela was ruled between 1908 and 1935 by a dictator called Juan Vicente Gomez. And the struggle for democracy was a struggle against his dictatorship, his dictatorial rule, and also a struggle to democratize oil wealth. So Venezuelans have always had some kind of association between the democratization of the political system and also the democratization of oil wealth that by law belongs to all Venezuelans. And so I think that if you want to understand how is it that Chavez came to become, you know, a particular leader that embodied a particular kind of conception of democracy, you have to understand that Venezuela, for let's say from 1958 to 1998, when Chavez became president, had a very stable democracy. Other countries like Argentina, Brazil, Chile, underwent dictatorships and back to democracies and dictatorships. Venezuela had a stable democracy, and a democracy that promised the Venezuelan people, because of its tremendous oil wealth, the benefits of, you know, democratization, development, health, education, etc. To a large extent, the Venezuelan state delivered to some of its promises. But particularly with the crisis of the global economy, starting, let's say, in the 1980s, when the whole development project of state-led development, began to fail, then the Venezuelan economy began to suffer the consequences of that and became much more divided between, let's say, a middle class and an upper class sector and a majority that was beginning to suffer the consequences of growing poverty. And Chavez is very much the product of that division of the country. So in 1998, when there was an election in which, as Bart says, the major contender was ex-Miss Universe, Chavez, if you listened, actually, I was in Caracas when I listened to the speech, first of Chavez, when he opened his electoral campaign, and then of Irene Sáenz, this lady, ex-Miss Universe. And the Chavez discourse was very similar to the discourse of most politicians in Venezuela since they were struggling against Gómez. Mm. It was a discourse against corruption. It was a discourse in which he said that he wanted to unify the nation. He wanted to use the benefits of the oil wealth to benefit the majority of the people, et cetera, et cetera. And that's basically, he has embodied an old aspiration, an ideal of Venezuelans, which is to use the wealth of the nation for the benefit of the majorities.
We have a correction from Dante in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. He says, a correction, the question of the referendum was not if Chavez could be a president for life, but if a president could be reelected indefinitely. He says these are two very different things. I think he's technically correct, but it was very much seen, was it not, Fernando Coronel?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's his own, basically whether he could be reelected indefinitely.
No, the correction is valid in that the reform was simply that the president could be elected indefinitely, not that Chavez himself could be. Of course, the assumption was that, you know, he would be the person who would be elected.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Karina. Karina Winnes from Reno in Nevada.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to ask how President Chavez has the power to set price controls over food items and kind of what those effects have been in his country.
Bart Jones, can you help us out there?
Well, this is not anything new, really, in Venezuelan history. Many other presidents have also set controls on prices of main food basics down there. Once again, though, when Chavez does it, it becomes a controversy. You know, he's the evil guy again. We see this kind of double standard when it comes to him. But, you know, he and many others have done it. It has certainly created some problems down there, though there have been shortages of some basic food goods down there, milk, sugar, eggs, things like that. And I think the government is now beginning to backtrack on some of these food price controls, lifting some of the controls on milk, for instance, in order to try to get it back on the shelves. So, you know, he has implemented some economic policies which have not helped the country, certainly, and his opponents will point that out. I just wanted to mention, too, on the referendum issue, again, this was not voting Chavez into office for life. He would have had to stand for re-election each time in a free and fair election, and he also could have been recalled at any time halfway through his term. He and his allies actually put into the 1999 Constitution a recall mechanism where if enough petitions are signed by people, they can put the president up to a vote and basically throw him out of office. So he would not have been, you know, reelected for life. He would have had to
periodic reelection.
Yeah, just to be fair about it and accurate about it, that's how it would have been.
Thanks very much for the call, Karina.
Thanks.
Joining us now from his home here in Washington, D.C. is James Early, Director of Cultural Heritage Policy at the Smithsonian Institution, who spent time with Hugo Chavez. And James, it's very nice of you to be with us today on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And you, too, have met Hugo Chavez in person. What is he like?
He's a very affable guy. One meeting him personally as opposed to seeing him on stage, you get a different measure of the man. He's an organic intellectual, as I have often described him, which means that he is someone who reads constantly and reads very widely. So he's a very engaging personality about substantive issues. To hear him quote 10 or 12 Latin American poets and novelists without a piece of paper is quite an impressive feat for a head of state who is preoccupied with the daily business of politics. But it's an indication of his very broad reading.
And I know that you've had some philosophical discussions with him as well. What can you characterize his philosophy?
Well, I think you've heard accurately described by the previous people that you've interviewed that from a philosophical view, he's a man of very deep humanistic perspectives, which means that he is very concerned and engaged with the state of the most marginalized of citizens. But I think one needs to expand that. He himself has stated quite frequently, publicly, that this is not a matter of Christian charity. It's a matter of recognizing the capacity inherent in each individual, notwithstanding how marginalized or what their suffering state might be, to act on their own and to collaborate with officials of government to change their lives, not for government to change their lives for them. That's a different construct of democracy, if you will, which is encapsulated in the phrase that you see emerging across Latin America, not as a result of Hugo Chavez. It actually predates Hugo Chavez, and that is the construct of participatory democracy, a construct that you even hear today in Cuba, which means that, again, the capacity of citizens to be creative, to envision possibilities, to do things in collaboration with officials is very much the humanistic philosophy that informs his ideological outlook, as well as the political policies unfolding. That philosophy gets extended in seeing a decentralized government apparatus that is not top-down, issuing dictates, delivering unto the people, but organizing networks of various scales across the nation, across the distinct communities to engage in changing the quality of their lives. So I think those are representative factors of this, what I would call this humanistic perspective that he brings.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jill. Jill with us from Columbus in Ohio.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to say my husband and I went to Corora in the state of Laura this past summer for a month, and we taught English there. We were so impressed by how involved people were with their government. We had people who had very little walking around with their constitution, being able to teach us about their rights. The people there showed us, we were introduced to the Julio Chavez, who is the mayor of the town. They invited us to look at clinics, the schools. We went to all the missions, the Mercal, obviously, housing places. And it was really a change in the mentality of the people, and the people were feeling empowered. And we, every day I cried from joy, from people's stories. We were able to go to people's houses. And I also wanted to say that they really encourage Americans to come and see what it's really like and ignore the media distortions. One thing, RCTV was something big that was happened last summer when they said that it had been shut down by Chavez. We actually watched it. I mean, it's on in bars, and you can see it all the time. It's our media completely distorts what's going on down there.
Okay. Jill, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And James Early, I think for a lot of Americans, the most exposure that they have to the politics of Venezuela is the television ads with Joe Kennedy providing oil to poor people in this country, heating oil provided by the country of Venezuela.
Indeed, people do have access, or that is an optic through which people look at Venezuela. But I think beyond the good deeds of Joe Kennedy in this regard, people, again, need to look at the broader participatory dimensions. Obviously, Joe Kennedy just cannot show up in a community in a particular state, identify on his own someone who should be the recipient of this. It means that people on the ground, people like Charlie Rangel in New York City.
Congressman Charles Rangel, yeah.
And whose district that oil is also distributed. And other local politicians at the level of city council and civic organizations are involved in this network of network, this participatory determination of where need is and how it should be allocated. allocated. And so that, I mean, I think one of our constrictions in both our media and our notion of democracy here in the United States is to see that personified absolutely in individuals and not see those individuals as expressions of broader social engagements, not always harmonious. A lot of debate comes through these things as to how they should be done. But certainly that's one of the ways in which the Venezuelans are reflected here. Less is known about the interest of Venezuela in New Orleans and the focus on working with communities on New Orleans to repair their homes and to help to build communities. Or, as the previous caller has acknowledged, the open arms of the Venezuelan government and the Venezuelan people for people to come and see for themselves firsthand and to speak to people directly. And that includes speaking to the opposition directly. No one is barred from speaking to the opposition. They're easily found, and for people to get their own read of this dynamic of democracy that's going on in Venezuela, and through that philosophy, the various expressions that are literally sweeping across Latin America.
James Early, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
James Early, Director of Cultural Heritage Policy at the Smithsonian Institution. We're talking about President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email question from Dolores. I'd like to know why Chavez replaced all of the judges when he took power. She also references the failure to renew the license of Radio Caracas Television. He may not be a dictator, she writes, but to say that Venezuela is a democracy is stretching the truth a bit. I wonder, Fernando Coronel, what do you think?
Well, I would like to comment on those issues. I mean, because one of the problems with you know, about talking about Chavez, as you said yourself, that, you know, he's a larger than life persona, and he produces very polarized images of Venezuela and also of himself. And I think it's important to have a more nuanced understanding, more complex understanding of what's happening in Venezuela. You know, on the one hand, one can appreciate, in fact, the fact that there is a huge mobilization and popular participation. And the previous caller talked about, you know, her enthusiastic appreciation mm-hmm. of how people are very involved in what's happening in Carora in Venezuela, and also how you could watch you know, the television station that whose license was closed down on bars. But one has to notice also that, for instance, that television station was closed down, and you can only watch it in bars or wherever because they have cable, and then they can, you know, can get it through that. But most Venezuelans cannot watch it anymore. And in terms of you know, popular participation, that James Early, you know, adequately emphasized that one of the, you know, the major goals of the Chavez regime is participatory democracy. The measure to close down the television station was highly unpopular. It was not, you know, if it was based on popular consultation, it would not have been closed down. So there are questions about, you know, to what extent, you know, participation actually takes place to the extent of what one would like to see it happening. And another example.
Did he replace the judges? And is that
he did replace the judges, and he did it. I mean, in fact, the judges were nominated largely after the coup. There was an expansion of the judges because the Supreme Court was first nominated by people who were very closely connected with the, you know, the Chavez government, which has actually placed in key positions many people who support the government. So in terms of the formal, I mean, there's, you know, formal separation of powers in Venezuela, and it's, in that sense, it's like a democracy. But in terms of the political affiliations of the people who are, you know, in those positions, they tend to be supporters of the government. And in the particular case of the Supreme Court, many of the people had been appointed by Luis Michelena, who was one of the major leaders of Chavismo and a tutor, of personal tutor of Chavez, both when he was in before he became president. And after the coup of 2002, the judges decreed that it was not a coup, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that Chavez did was, you know,
rewrite history a little bit.
Well, actually, yeah, nominate other judges who then rewrote history, and so they declared it as a coup. So there was, you know, those kind of things did happen in Venezuela.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. Fernando Coronil is the presidential professor of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, author of The Magical State. He was with us from our bureau in New York. We'll continue to talk about Hugo Chavez with Bart Jones, the author of Hugo, a biography of Hugo Chavez. And if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Also, President's Day is on the Talk of the Nation opinion page. You may be enjoying your day off, but Professor Werner Lang calls it contrived, confused, and confusing. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're about to get to the Talk of the Nation opinion page, but first we'll wrap up our conversation about Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, the man whose every musing reads like a provocative op-ed. Our guest is Chavez biographer Bart Jones. His book is called Hugo, and we're taking your calls and email questions. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Let's go to Brad. Brad's on the line with us from Des Moines in Iowa.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is concerning specifically Hugo Chavez's relationship with the leaders of mainly Iran, but also Syria, specifically dealing with his relationship with the president of Iran. I'm wondering if you could give insight as to what his political motivations might be for that relationship, considering that the president of Iran has popularity problems not only abroad, but also, you know, amongst his own people at home. He's not seen as being, you know, the he's not seen as being very politically strong even at home. So I was wondering if you could help me understand as to why he feels this is a good political relationship for him.
Bart Jones?
Well, I think the basic answer is oil. Iran was a founding member also of OPEC, as Venezuela was, and this is not a new relationship. Venezuela has had relationships with these Middle Eastern countries for decades, as has the United States. We are friends with Saudi Arabia, which I think hardly anyone would classify as a democracy. So these are, you know, kind of, you know, real-world political relationships that Chavez, like other leaders, have entered into. You know,
Syria is not an oil producer.
Excuse me?
Syria is not an oil producer.
No, but many of these controversial countries that he's involved with are. And, you know, does he need to flaunt this relationship? Is that a smart idea politically? You know, even some of his allies would argue it's not. But this is part of the reason that he's entered into these relationships. Also, he's looking for allies anywhere he can find them, pretty much. The United States government has essentially declared war on Chavez. They supported the 2002 coup against him, a coup, by the way, during which Chavez was, by his account, almost executed. So he feels that the United States government, the Bush administration, we should say, is really out to have him overthrown, pretty much. And he is going to look for allies anywhere he can get it, sometimes among unsavory regimes, you know, no doubt about it. But, you know, the U.S. itself and other countries have done the same type of thing at times as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Brad. And finally, do you think that he will... We've spoken of his admiration for Fidel Castro, among other things. Do you think that he will appropriate the cult of personality that so many leftist presidents have used in other countries?
Well, you know, it's certainly a danger, Neil, and that's one thing that people have to look for. You know, Chavez's movement clearly is too much dependent on Hugo Chavez. There's a real feeling that if he disappeared tomorrow, the whole movement might collapse. So he needs to diversify his leadership. I think that's one of the lessons that the people have given him with this defeat that he suffered last December. They need to find new leaders in his movement. I did want to just comment, too, on the television station issue that which folks have spoken about. Once again, we kind of heard a very simplistic version of that. Chavez shut them down because they were criticizing him. Well, it's a little more complex than that. Radio Caracas Television took part in the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez. They basically helped try to have him overthrown. And one thing they did was there was a news blackout in Venezuela after he was kidnapped for 2 days and went missing. When his supporters took to the streets to demand that he be returned, there was no news on television for 2 days. So in the case of Radio Caracas Television, it goes a little bit beyond them simply criticizing the president. It goes to them really trying to overthrow a democratically elected president. So, again, the situation is a little bit more complex in Venezuela than folks have sometimes been led to believe, I think.
Bart Jones, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Bart Jones, the author of Hugo, a biography of Hugo Chavez, and he was with us today from WRHU in Hempstead in New York.